Hello, I'm Rosie Goldsmith, and this is the Commonwealth Writers Podcast, celebrating 10 short story writers from 5 regions of the Commonwealth. We're calling it 10 by 10, which means I've got 10 minutes to talk to each author. Today I'm here with the Canadian writer Margaret Atwood. Margaret Atwood, do you identify yourself as a Commonwealth writer?
When people from the Commonwealth are gathered together and are of a certain generation, we compare our educations, in which A is for apple, referred to English apples. So, for instance, if you're talking to somebody from the Caribbean, to them an apple was something quite different. They didn't have those kinds of apples. But I think that's a generational thing. I think now younger people probably don't feel that they had this very British education that didn't quite jigsaw with their lived experience.
Do you see that you have certain things in common with Commonwealth writers, apart from the fact that this vague link with the British Commonwealth?
New Zealand, for sure, because, of course, smaller country with large dominant country nearby, namely Australia. So there's a certain amount of, I understand what you're saying, with the New Zealanders. With the Australians, what you have is a past in which you were an offshoot of empire. And if you're a white Australian person, you came from one set of circumstances. Or if you were an Aboriginal Australian, you would have a very different experience. So what we all have, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, we all have an incoming European population and already there a very different set of cultures that were encountered and badly treated. And you know that there is a kind of totem pole of hierarchy amongst Commonwealth countries. And India was the jewel in the crown. It was considered the absolute most wonderful thing. And then the others were arranged in order of boringness, and Canada was considered absolutely the most boring. So we had to live with that as well.
Now, as a writer, you've danced on many tables. You've written novels and plays and radio plays and film scripts and a libretto, I think. Where do short stories fit into your life?
Short stories and poetry were the two forms that we were able to publish in the 60s more easily than novels in Canada. This fits in with your Canadian question. So novels are long. Therefore, they take more financial investment on the part of publishers. In the first part of the 60s, it was hard to publish novels if you were a Canadian writer because nobody wanted to invest in you. They thought that they would not be able to sell the product, to be quite crass. But there was a wonderful radio program run by a man called Robert Weaver, and it was called Anthology. And that's where a number of us got our start. Anthology, Alice Munro published their first, I published their first with poetry and then stories. And there were also literary magazines, not very many of them, but Mavis Gallant, who just died, got her start through a small literary journal which published two of her stories, her first ones. She then was able to get published by The New Yorker, where she stayed for many, many years. But that first publication was in Canada because you could. So a lot of us wrote stories because we could get them published somehow or another. When I asked people in Wales when I was there why there were so many Welsh short story writers, they said, because you can't support yourself as a full-time writer in Wales, but you can write stories in your spare time.
Do short stories have the same level of engagement for you? I mean, do you feel that the topics that you're very well known for writing about, science and gender and history and dystopias and utopias and ideology. I mean,
do you...
It is a very, very long list of subjects that you write about. Because, I mean, I can't think of a single piece of writing of yours that hasn't in some way, and I mean this most sincerely, changed me in some way and made me think. I mean, is that a deliberate act on your part as a writer?
Yeah, I think it's just the world that we live in. Anybody, unless they're living in a padded cell and that is excluding everything else that's going on, we all are in connection somehow with our time and our and our place. You can't just keep it out. Those are the kinds of things that people are thinking about. So unless you're writing about the past, you know, a past in which those things are not there yet, they're of necessity going to at least cross the character's mind.
If there were a tool that you could invent, I mean, you are very inventive in everything you do. If there were a tool you could invent in your wildest dreams, what would it be? Something to help literature?
Well, first of all, if I knew, I wouldn't tell you, would I?
I'd do the business IP brand first. Manager, yes.
I'd do the IP first. There are already a number of tools out there, and I have a piece called Why Wattpad Works, which you can find on the Guardian website.
It's a story-sharing...
Site, but imagine if you were a person in a developing country and you were a young person. So you might not have lots of money. You might not be able to even buy e-books. You might not have a library. You might not have a school even. You might not have a bookstore, but you've probably got a phone. So 70% of Wattpad goes on over people's phones. Now imagine you're a young writer at school. You're 15. You don't have a credit card. The only thing available to you until the internet would have been the school yearbook, where you were unlikely to publish your steamy vampire novel, which is what really interests you, because your parents, your teacher, and your peer group would all read it and know it was by you. On a story-sharing site such as Wattpad, you can practice. You can be an apprentice writer. You can call yourself Cloak of Darkness or whatever you want. Nobody knows it's you. So it's very encouraging to young writers.
It's good for Commonwealth writers as well. I mean, for sharing all these multiple voices.
You don't know where anybody is either. If they say they're in Timbuktu, they might be there. But you, the reader, do not know.
So, Margaret, you're going to read a short passage or two from Mad Adam, which is your latest novel.
The fur trade. There's the story, then there's the real story, then there's the story of how the story came to be told, then there's what you leave out of the story, which is part of the story, too. In the story of Zeb and the Bear, Toby has left out the dead man, whose name was Chuck. He, too, was lost among the pools and moss and mountains and bears. He, too, did not know the way out. It's unfair to deny him a mention, erase him from time, but putting him into the story would cause more knots and tangles than Toby is prepared to deal with. For instance, she doesn't yet know how this dead man wormed his way into the story in the first place. "Too bad the fucker died," says Zeb. "I'd have twisted it out of him." "It? Who hired him? What they wanted? Where he would have taken me?" "Died is a euphemism, I take it. He didn't have a heart attack," says Toby. "Don't be harsh. You know what I mean." Zeb was lost. He sat down under a tree. Or not lost completely. He did have a rough idea of where he was. He was somewhere on the Mackenzie Mountain Barrens, hundreds of miles from anywhere with fast food. And not under a tree, more like beside. And not a tree exactly, more like a shrub. Though not bushy, more like spindly. A spindly kind of spruce. He noticed the details of the trunk, the small dead underbranches, the gray lichen on it, frilly and intricate and see-through, like Hora's underpants. "What do you know about Hora's underpants?" says Toby. "More than you want me to," says Zeb. "So, when you focus on details like that, close up, really clear, totally useless, you know you're in shock."
Thank you so much, Margaret Atwood. That was Margaret Atwood reading from Mad Adam. And that's our 10 minutes. I'm Rosie Goldsmith, and that was 10 by 10, the Commonwealth Writers Podcast.